Okay, so today is the 14th of May 2009, and we are on the campus of the Free University Berlin in Berlin, Germany. And I'm Alexander Freund, and I'm interviewing Karin Jungblut of the Shoah Visual History Foundation for Oral History Forum d'Histoire Orale. And this is a general interview about your own experience with oral history, and particularly with video history, but also your experiences at the Shoah Foundation. So maybe we can begin by just if you could just tell us a bit about yourself, where you were born, when you were born, family, school, university studies, sort of up to the point to where you came to the foundation.
Okay, so do you want the long story or the short story?
I'm gonna give you the long story. You can always edit.
Okay, well, I was born in 1964 in Hofgeismar, Germany, which is a small little town near Kassel. My family moved to Funkstadt, which is was near Darmstadt, Frankfurt, sometime. I don't remember because I was a little kid. Sometime in the 60s, I think late 60s. Anyway, so I grew up in Funkstadt near Darmstadt, and I went to school in Darmstadt. Typical family, had a brother, had a sister. Went to school in Darmstadt. I went into a private Catholic girls' school, which was not very usual for Germany, because there weren't too many private high schools in Germany.
Mm-hmm.
And I think at the time it was either one or the second or third only ones that actually existed. And the name of the school was Edith Stein Schule. And it was named after Edith Stein, who was born Jewish and became a Carmelite nun and was killed by the Nazis because she was Jewish.
Mm-hmm.
And so going to the school, it was a very, I think 10 years before I got there, there were still nuns basically running the school and teaching. And by the time I came around, it was already, you know, more civilian teachers, so to speak, but it was a very strict school. And there was lots of other high schools around it, and they always had, they were always doing things that we were never allowed to do. There was a lot more freedom in the other high schools, and being it was a private and Catholic and girls' school, it was a very different experience that most of my friends had who went to different high schools. Now, in hindsight, I would say it was pretty good. I'm actually glad I went to that school. During those days, I hated it. Our school building was clean. There was never really any political graffiti was like unheard of, and just everybody was behaving well, even though we were more of a rebel group, the class I was in. And you had to, every Friday morning, you had to go to church. There was the first hour Friday morning, which we tried to skip as much as we could, and hang out in the, you know, local cafe or something like that. And when you got caught, you got in trouble, things like that. And so I graduated in 1983. And I didn't want to, I wanted to get away. I wanted to get away from my family. I wanted to get away from Germany. There wasn't sort of an intellectual thought about, I really want to get away because this and that and this. It was just, I just wanted to, I didn't know what to do. I really had no plans. I didn't want to study, really, at least at that point. I sort of had enough of school, and I just wanted to just run, I guess. And so, totally by coincidence, I heard about a friend of mine. I had a friend who was applying for a pair jobs in the United States, and she got an offer for a family in New York City, a German family who's been living there for 10 years already, who had two children and always wanted to have German nannies so that the children speak German at home and grow up bilingual. So this friend didn't want to do it. New York City was too far for her, and she was afraid. And she said, how about you? And I said, I'll take it. And so we had meetings with this family, because they actually lived they came from the near Heidelberg, so that was near where I was, and so we met. We kind of sort of, they checked me out, you know, is she appropriate? Is this somebody we want to allow to enter our family? So long story short, they said yes, and 3 months later, September, I think, 83, I flew to New York City. And it was supposed to be for a year. Well, once I got there and stayed with them, and sort of the first year, they also enrolled me at the time. Anyway, so they, I was also enrolled in a, and this family was just very kind to house me and let me live with them, and I was so happy about that that I thought I'll take care of their children. And so I was enrolled in the Spanish American Business Institute, which was this, it still exists actually, it's a like a business school right next to New York Times, 42nd Street. Mm. And they had a lot of, they have a lot of students, immigrant students, so to speak, or from South America. So a lot of folks go there to learn how to type, how to do basic accounting, learn basic secretarial skills, those kinds of things. And of course the name is Spanish American Business Institute. They make the sound, you know, the name of the institute is much bigger than what you actually really learn there. But it was kind of interesting just to go there every day. I had my classes, so I actually learned how to type, and I took English classes too. And the thing with English, I didn't speak any word of English the first 3 months I set foot in New York City. And we lived in Manhattan. I lived in 96th Street and 5th Avenue. Beautiful apartment. I had my own room looking over the Central Park. It was, I was sort of thrown from this small German town into smack middle of Manhattan into family. We had Alistair Cook. I don't know if that's a name. He lived right above us, met him in the elevator almost every day. Almost said, so what's going to be from America next week? So it was very interesting. Anyway, so the first 3 months I didn't speak any word of English because the kids, they spoke English fluently. And so when we went shopping, grocery shopping in Christides, which was the supermarket right around the corner, I was too embarrassed to say anything because I had a German accent, if I spoke at all. When I graduated, one of my problems actually was I almost did not graduate. And my teachers, I think they, I'm not going to go into the specifics of it, but I think one of my teachers helped me actually make it, because I know my English, I was just barely with the points. I think I had 3 out of 15 points, and I know you have to have at least 5. And then I had another course where I just had, I think my final was like 8 or 7 points. Anyway, so, and then I had sports as my Wahlfach that I could choose, and I was very good in sports, so I got 15 in my theoretical oral sports examination. And when I studied for that, one of my sport teachers said, there's a specific question that she went over with me all the time, and she just sort of made it sound like, well, you know, it could be one of those or this, maybe it's this, let's just study this a little more. And so what I think happened, that she knew what the question was, and that she just tried to help me by really studying. Of course, that was the question that came, and I was able to fly through that. And anyway, so I was able to graduate. So my English was really bad. That's really the point of the story. And so I was too embarrassed to speak, especially because I had a 4-year-old and a 6-year-old who spoke like, you know, Americans. Mm-hmm. And first, you know, they needed to get to know me. You know, I was already their, I don't know, third nanny, so to speak. And so the first thing, you know, little kids, they kind of hear you say things that they think is funny, and then they make fun of you. And so I, you know, I kept my mouth shut. I spoke German, and that was it. And when we went out, I always like sent them in front of the store clerk or had them ask it or something like that. And then even like my first experience in the supermarket, I never forget that either. They knew the family, they knew the kids, they knew that the kids always had somebody with them that was a nanny, so to speak. And so I came in, and so they said, oh, that's the new one. Those kinds of things. And I said, let's check out her legs. Is she shaving or is she not shaving? You know, the typical, there's a few of German women that don't shave their arms and their legs and stuff. So they were like, look, and I'm like, I'm going, what the hell happened to me? Where did I end up? It was very bizarre. I still remember that to the day. And so I just somehow I remember that after 3 months, I kind of came out of that fear or embarrassment or something. I said, you know, I gotta do something. I gotta like talk and I gotta get out. And so I also went out for the first time to a nightclub, and it was like a big thing. I heard about one, and my boss, or my boss, well, the mother, she was a photojournalist, and so she received a lot of invitations to nightclubs and things. She was sort of on that list. And so there's one, and so one day I just took it, and she said, you can have it. And so at 12 o'clock at night, I got into a cab in front of, you know, the house, and went downtown to 12th or whatever, and I went to the nightclub for the first time. And it was this thing of, I had no idea what to expect. I didn't know, really. I had like a trench coat on, and I looked like Inspector Clouseau. If I look back, I was all like wrapped up in this trench coat, trying to be, you know, it was more fear. I just covered myself up because I didn't want really to be seen, and I just wanted to be able to just like, I don't know, go through it without anybody seeing me kind of stuff. So this cab drops me off in front of this nightclub thing, and it's this typical thing, you know, this long line of people, the guard, the what do they call them? I was going to say, the doorman. Doorman outside, big guys.
The bouncers?
Yeah, they're bouncers. I mean, bouncers are doormen. Bouncers are usually outside because they bounce you out. That's the whole point of bouncers. Doormen are, you know, they're checking out who they're letting in, only certain people kind of thing, right?
Mm.
It's this whole thing. And so I had no clue about this, really. This was just sort of like, okay. So I get out of the cab, stops right in front. I get out, and the doorman just opens that red velvet thing. And I just marched right in. I didn't know that there was a line, you have to stand in line. I just saw these people in the line, but I'm just, he opens the thing and I'm just walking right through and going, okay, so far so good. And then I didn't have to pay because I had this ticket thing. And then I was in there for probably, sure, 4 hours at one spot.
Mm-hmm.
That's it. I walked through it one time, and then I found a spot and I leaned against the wall. And that's where I stayed for 4 hours because I was so terrified to move and anybody to talk, that anybody would talk to me or anything like that. And then I left 4 hours later. But I came back the next night, and then it seemed much smoother, and I was enjoying myself.
Mm.
So it was almost like this, it was this weird breaking the ice kind of thing. Anyway, so I ended up being with this family for about 3.5 years.
Mm.
And I, the Spanish American Institute, the kind of studies I did there was, and the reason why I said this whole thing about English before is because the English I learned there, I already knew, which to me was like, okay, I was the worst English student my high school probably has ever seen, that sort of barely made it through the Abitur. And you know, here in the United States, I'm studying English at a school that I even know everything already what I'm learning.
Mm-hmm.
So, long story short, I think after a year or so, I decided to apply to go to college. And so I checked out Hunter College and got the application, applied. You had to get some stuff translated. I translated it, had it certified by the German Embassy in New York. They did that. And I got accepted. And
mm-hmm.
I didn't even think about, well, because the family helped me with the tuition for the Spanish American Institute, and I didn't think about, well, Hunter College, maybe a little more money now than the Spanish American Institute. And so I got accepted, and then somehow they said it's okay, and they were helpful, and then I was able to go to Hunter College and study.
Wow.
During those last 2.5 years. Yeah, I think the 1 year Spanish American Institute, and then I was with them when I was still studying for about 2.5 years after college. So, you know, I was doing all the kind of things that somebody does when you're kind of the nanny mother of 4-year-old and 6-year-old. And they get, you know, they go to school and you do all of these things. So I'm not going to speak much about this family at all because I don't think that's of interest anyway. But after 3.5 years, it was time to go. For a variety of reasons, and I moved in with my boyfriend that I had at that time.
Okay, so you stayed in New York?
I stayed in New York, that's right. Out of 1 year, it was sort of like, okay, so the year was coming to an end, and it kind of happened so quickly. And I think at that time I started to already be enrolled or got accepted by Hunter College, or said, you know, I want to stay another year. Is that okay? They were very happy that I would stay. It's good for the kids. And, you know, I said, sure, I want to stay. And I think then I started to have this sort of feeling, I can't go back to Germany until I accomplished something. So being that I then was enrolled at Hunter College, it was sort of like, well, I can't go back until I finished my BA at least. Because how's that going to look? What are my parents going to think? And also I wasn't really that worried about my parents, I think. Well, maybe I was. I just wasn't going to admit it. And then, anyway, so I moved in with my boyfriend and I studied at Hunter College, continued to study at Hunter College, and then it just was, I need to figure out how to pay now for everything. And so I had a couple of jobs that, well, they were let's just say, outside of the ordinary, in that respect. not to make this sound any kind of weird, but anyway, I worked. One, I was a cleaning lady for, actually, Ullstein.
Ullstein?
Yeah.
The publisher?
Yeah, the daughter.
Oh.
Because he left, you know, her father and she, and I don't know if I know the whole story totally, completely at all. I don't even know it now. I only know things from her. But she was the daughter of the Ullstein in the 30s. They sold to Springer. They had to sell because they were Jewish. And they escaped to the States. And she lived somewhere in the middle, in the east side, somewhere in the 50s or 60s. Had an apartment. I think she owned the apartment, but you know, she was quite old, and she was also I don't know if she had Alzheimer, but her memory was shot. But shot in the sense that things that happened 2 seconds ago she didn't remember really. But she kind of remembered. She was telling me stories about how she still remembered going to the Französische Schule in Berlin, and her Schulweg and things like that, and then how things got really bad, and you know, and Nazis came to power, and all the things that people were saying to her because she was Jewish. And so it was just interesting, and all I was doing, I was coming there every other day or so cleaning her apartment. Because when I was at Hunter, I ran into another person who happens to also be German, and she was a nurse, and she was hired by Frau Ullstein to be her nurse, so to speak. And so she then said, listen, I need somebody to clean, you need a job, why don't we do that? And I said, sure, I'll do anything, so I can pay my tuition. And so I did that, and I was also student work at the Russian department at Hunter College, which I was able to do. I think you can do that as a foreign student after a year or so when you studied there. They allowed you to do that. And so I was the assistant to one of the Russian professors there who's been there for, I think, forever. His name was Professor Alex Alexander. Yes. Alex Alexander. And so I was a student assistant in the Russian department. And then I also did a job for a journalism professor at Hunter College who I took a course with, and he needed somebody he wanted somebody to arrange his library, fix his library. And so I said, and so he asked me, are you interested? Now, I wasn't studying library science. What I was studying at Hunter College was actually international affairs. History, but the focus, the major was this, they had this specific program in there that was about international affairs, and so there were certain kinds of courses you needed to take in order to get the degree in international affairs, but it was within the history department. And so my advisor was Professor Michael Luther, who also taught at Columbia University. And he was also he was married to I think Italian wife, because we once talked about the life of somebody who living in the United States as not being an American, and like the immigrant and what it's like and the problems and the issues, and I was sort of having cultural, I think, not issues, but we were just talking about this, and he's saying, well, that sounds like my wife, kind of thing. Anyway, so he So this journalism professor, and I don't remember his name, so I went to his house every Saturday or so, and I rearranged his library, organized it and rearranged it for, I don't know how many months I did that, and, you know, got paid for it. So, which is kind of interesting when I look back at this, the kind of jobs I did
mm-hmm.
and what I'm doing now, which
mm-hmm.
is kind of organizing data, information, you know, those kinds of things. And it's totally serendipity. It wasn't, you know, on my mind, this is what I'm going to do.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason I was studying international affairs because I couldn't think of anything better. Mm-hmm. And I was always, it's not totally true, I was always interested in, like, even high school, I was interested in history and social science and just political science kind of things, what's going on in the world and what are people doing and why are they doing this. And I had also a period in, when I was 15, 16, 17, I was part of an exchange program that the city organized of Darmstadt between young people in Darmstadt and Israelis.
Mm.
And so I was part of this, except that since I wasn't living in Darmstadt and it was for the city of Darmstadt, I was on the waiting list because I came from outside of Darmstadt.
Mm.
So I couldn't go to Israel with the group. But when the Israelis came to Darmstadt, they somebody fell off the list. They couldn't house the person that they stayed with when they were in Israel. And so I had one of an Israeli girl stay with my house for
mm.
3 weeks. And what was more, you were part of that group now, and we all traveled through Germany together for 3 weeks. We spent basically 24 hours a day together, the Israelis and the Germans. And it was about, of course, because of the history, etc. It was this kind of program, and I think a lot of cities still do that to, you know, help the relationship between Israel and Germany
mm-hmm.
and the young people that are growing up. And it was an incredible 3 weeks. It was like, if I think back, it was like we had so much fun. And the best thing was really is that you had these obligatory kinds of visits we had to do. So we, you know, we went to Heidelberg and we went to Reinheim or and all these places, and we went to places where there was good wine. And you know, we were in 16, 17, we weren't adults yet, you know, and drinking was okay. And so we were doing all these kind of fun, typical things,
mm-hmm.
and then of course we went to Munich, and we went to Dachau, and we walked through Dachau together.
Mm.
And my remembrance, and that was the first time that I was, that I went to a concentration camp, and was confronted with it in that manner. Thing that I didn't say, the reason I was named after a character in a book that actually was a character then in a movie. So when my mother was pregnant, I guess 63, 64, the film Exodus came out.
Hmm.
Leon Uris,
mm-hmm.
which is Otto Preminger, made the film. My mom went to see the film, and there's this character in there, her name is Karen, is one of the main characters. She gets killed by the Palestinians at the end. And when she's in Palestine. Anyway, so my mom sees this film, is so taken by it, and she said, if this is the daughter, then her name is going to be Karen.
Hmm.
And so I got this book when I was, I don't know, 8, 9 or so, and so it became, I was like enthralled by this book. And it was always this history, or this story in my family about that I was named after this character. Anyway, and then I had also, then I started, before even the Israelis, I started to, was interested in learning Hebrew, so I was part of a group and we studied Hebrew, the old Hebrew.
Mm.
And there was actually a moment when I was able to read an old text from the old Bible. And there was like one sentence I was able to read, and I was so proud of it. And after that, I just stopped because it was kind of becoming too difficult. I thought, you know what? I don't know. No, I don't think so. It was a little too much. But I had this girlfriend that was so into it. She studied Greek and she studied Latin. She was fluent in Latin. And she became later on also a teacher of Latin and Greek.
Mm.
She was totally into it. So anyway, so there are only these little points in my life that kind of are interesting now in hindsight.
Mm-hmm.
But none of this was sort of a straight line and, you know, strategically planned at each step. So anyway, so that... going through Dachau with this Israeli group was very traumatic. The closer we got to the camp, the harder it was for us. And then we really, the German kids and the Israeli kids, we weren't together in the bus, And as soon as we walked out of the bus, we were two separate groups.
Mm.
It was like a natural selection that happened,
mm.
which is an interesting word, using that right in front of Dachau. But that's what happened in the bus parking spot there in front of the Dachau concentration camp memorial. And then we walked.
And you said it became harder the closer you got. What
because
what
it was
harder?
Sort of knowing that you're getting closer to this place.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, we all knew what the place was about.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I've had things in school already. We've learned this. I had a lot of education about the Holocaust in school,
mm-hmm.
which I'm not sure it's necessarily because of the school I went to, Edith Stein, and the legacy of Edith Stein, or also because we had a teacher who was quite. Quite engaged in that kind of history, and was very open about this. And actually, there were a couple of teachers.
Mm-hmm.
So we were confronted with this from fairly early on, I would say, 5th, 6th grade, 7th grade. I can't pinpoint it, but I know it was always, I always felt like it was always part of it.
Mm-hmm.
I sort of grew up with it from day one. Even though my family never ever discussed, never talked about. There was only one moment. When I was growing up, when I was at my grandfather's house in Hofgeismar, because my father's family is from Hofgeismar, my mother's family is from Hosenfeld, which is near Fulda.
Mm.
So totally, and my mom actually went to Hofgeismar, which was this big thing, this little country dorf girl going to a big city. I'm doing this all in quotes because Hosenfeld is really tiny little dorf, and Hofgeismar is not really a big city, but you know, comparatively speaking, I guess, those things. But so we were at my grandmother's house because we went there off her vacation, and I loved my grandparents. My grandfather, he fought in World War II. He was a soldier on the Eastern Front, and the story always was, the only thing that I remember always hearing is that he was flown out of Stalingrad in the last with the last plane.
Mm.
He got out with the last plane. He was hurt badly, and he was flown, ended up in Vienna in a hospital, in a military hospital. And I remember my grandmother always saying that she had to go to the military. She went to the military hospital and she stayed there for 5 months or so, even though she had 5 kids.
Mm.
And yeah, my grandmother always told us the story of how she raised 5 kids on her own and how tough and all that kind of stuff. And then later on, we always heard that she actually had a helper,
mm.
because she was a good German mother that had 5 kids that served by the German Reich, but she gets a servant, basically,
mm.
That helps her with the kids. So I think a lot of it is, my grandmother, who's still alive today, 96, who I just talked to last time I was here, and I'm going to probably talk to her again about her story, because it's an interesting story about her and my grandfather, how they met and when they got married, and they already had a child before they got married, and it was 1935, and her wedding 1935. Her neighbor, who was Jewish, who was a Jewish shoe store owner, had come and had given her a Tischdecke,
tablecloth
as a wedding gift,
huh.
And she still has it. And then and when I always say, so what happened to them? Do you know? And she said, no, I don't know. They were just gone one day.
Hmm.
I said, do you know why or where? Well, you know, I know things weren't good, but no, I don't really know. We don't know what happened. You know, I had this typical, we never knew, we weren't political, we didn't know what was going on, we never saw anything, but all of a sudden they lived next to us, and the next day they weren't. And then she talks about one night she could really get shoes very cheaply from next door.
Mm-hmm.
But really why and how, that's kind of a mystery to her.
Mm.
At least the way she talks about this,
mm-hmm.
today. But I totally transgress. Anyway, so when we were playing in front of the TV commode, we opened it up and there were a bunch of books in there, and one of them had to do with Hitler. It was Mein Kampf.
Mm.
I remember that. And my grandmother running into the living room and going like, kids, no, 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 these books are not for you. These are not good for you. These books are not good for you. And so she took a bunch of books, wrapped them up, and walked away with them. And it's also one of those memories that I never forgot. There was no significance thereafter, nothing. It's just that I clearly remember that incident.
Mm.
It was with my cousins. Anyway, so so the story about what my grandparents did. So in my family, we never talked about this history. It was just not part of it. But I heard about it in school. The only thing, you know, even though my mom watched the film, I got named after this character, and I got this book from my aunt. I think it was even for communion or something like that. And I grew up with this. Anyway, so in Dachau, the whole thing, basically, as I said, we got off the bus, and all of a sudden, we were two separate groups, Israeli and Germans, and we were both walking through Dachau separately. We had to congregate at some point because it was sort of a guided tour too, but we were all, at least we Germans, were very quiet, and we kind of, I think we were all in shock.
Mm.
I remember going through it all on my own. I couldn't go with anybody.
Mm.
I ran through that thing. I couldn't, I was crying like a crazy person.
Mm.
And I didn't want to have to deal, I didn't want to see anybody, I didn't want to go with anybody, nothing. And then we had to kind of congregate together. And
so was it the exhibition or was it just the ground?
I don't even remember the exhibition.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember, I remember walking through the grounds.
Mm-hmm.
I remember there was like grass and it looked like there used to be a barracks or something.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm walking on Kieselstein or something like that, and I see there was a building at the end, and then I remember the square with the also the big building, which is a little sort of square that we had to stand in front because they were telling us about Dachau. But I really don't remember anything that is of information that was given to me about the place. I know it happened, and
mm-hmm.
I remember I'm seeing myself standing there with the group. That there's somebody who's talking,
mm.
but I have no memory of what was said,
mm.
nothing. I only remember going through it, crying, and being totally devastated, and not wanting to see anybody and be with anybody.
Mm.
And I wasn't the only one.
Mm.
There was a bunch of us who reacted like this.
What made you cry?
I was just that, the feeling of what happened here,
mm.
and that it was us, Germans, who did this.
Mm.
And the Israelis, they were like, they were loud, they were laughing, they were just talking and sort of like, yeah, you know, and you and stuff. And why I'm also talking about this, because the 3 weeks we had, as I said, we were together 24 hours a day.
Mm-hmm.
And we made friends. They were, you know, Israeli boyfriend and German girlfriend and vice versa. And all these like things happened. These romantic relationships got started. You know, we were 16, 17, 15. It was sort of the range, and we had so much fun together, and we laughed and jokes, and it was great. But when it came to that obligatory kind of stuff, which was the whole reason of why we were put together to begin with,
mm-hmm.
we became two separate camps, so to speak. And so Dachau was sort of just one way of how it sort of got implemented, this whole thing of separation when it came to this, when the history got talked about, or when we went to a place where the history was so present. And it was just that feeling. It's the feeling of having been there. I don't know if my thinking or something took just went totally nuts, and I kind of felt like I'm a prisoner, and then I'm imprisoned, and I'm just like I was a prisoner before my former life. And I'm coming back to it, and I'm seeing it now. I think that's like, I'm not doing a Shirley, you know, that's like, you know, I'm reborn somebody else now kind of thing in my head, you know. But it just, I think that sort of felt like that,
mm.
if I had to describe it now. And so that sort of was the experience. And then we went back on the bus, and then I think for a couple of hours, we were all just like, leave me alone, just don't talk to me or whatever. And then couple of hours later, we just all, you know, ended up in somebody's room with the beer and the wine and the, the chips or whatever, and we had, you know, the good old times again. And then when we had meetings that were guided by our counselors to talk about the history and how we feel about this, I remember also one where we sat on one table. It was a nice one table. Israel is on one side, the Germans all on the other side. And all what was happening, the Israelis were pointing at us, how could you have done this? How could you have done this? How could you have done this? And we're going like, we weren't alive. What are you talking about? We weren't alive. What are we talking about? That was the jinx.
Mm.
There was it was really totally just like that. There was no really exchange, and
mm-hmm.
there was no sort of moving to closer and understanding each other. Didn't happen.
Mm.
In that moment.
Mm.
Outside of that, we were the best friends.
Mm.
And we had the best times together.
Mm.
It was it was totally bizarre.
Mm-hmm.
But really, that's the way I remember it many years later. But those things just stuck with me. I mean, that totally stuck with me.
Yeah.
And so I don't think it's sort of that hindsight memory kind of thing, because I can feel it.
Mm-hmm.
I can go back into those emotions when we're sitting at the table, going through Dachau. I can go right in there.
Mm-hmm.
And so and that sort of tells me that there's something there.
Mm-hmm.
That's that, which is the emotion. It's the emotional memory that triggers then the, you know, the thought that we're at the time.
Mm.
Anyway, boy. So actually I was in New York, right?
Yeah.
Studied at Hunter College and
moved in with your boyfriend.
Moved in with my boyfriend, Hoboken, in Jersey. So from 96th and 5th Avenue with a nice view over, you know, Central Park, with the doorman and downstairs and going to East Hampton every week because they had a house in East Hampton. Living really the life of the rich, not famous, just seeing the famous. But moving in, being on your own, well, with my boyfriend who's American, living in Hoboken in a small apartment on 2nd Street, right next to very low income housing, and but being basically free. I mean, at the end, it just didn't work with the family anymore, and just they overstayed my welcome, and they overstayed their welcome to me in that respect. It just didn't work anymore.
Mm-hmm.
It made also total sense to, you know, at the time it was very, very difficult. So I wasn't allowed to see the kids anymore right away. I was a total no more. Children and you know, we really got attached for 3.5 years, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I was oftentimes their mother because their own mother traveled a lot. Sometimes she went to China for 3 months, time, and she every other 2 weeks or 3 weeks she went for 2 weeks or 3 weeks. She was a photojournalist, so she traveled around the world to take photos.
Mm.
And I was then the mother, so to speak. Anyway. So the first year out away from that was great and difficult at the same time, because trying to find jobs, trying to make it, trying to be able to survive. I continued to have a student visa because I was at Hunter College, so legally I was okay. And then I knew somebody who worked at an NGO that was associated with the United Nations. And so I volunteered with that group called WFUNIF, World Association of Former United Nations Interns. I think that's what that organization is like. And so I was working for them and volunteered for them. And then, you know, I said, I need a job. And one of them, who was actually Diego Maradona, the soccer player,
mm-hmm.
his cousin. My God. Some of the characters I met. His cousin worked there too. He was also a volunteer or helped with UNIF. And he and I, we became sort of friends. And he had a friend who was, his family left once the Shah got ousted. He was from Iran, Persia. I don't know if his family was part of the Shah's family or something, but there was some sort of, it wasn't clear. There was some big secret about him always. And he what was his name? Diego Maradona's cousin. I forgot. Anyway, they were very good friends. So they were always together. And they and I, we became sort of friends. It was kind of a funny buddy-buddy kind of thing. It was always interesting. Persians, the Argentinian, and the German hanging out together. And we were all three sort of in the mid-20s. So we were similar age-wise, I think. Anyway, so that one of them said, you know, why don't you apply for the UN for a job during the GA in the September, in the fall? They always look for a lot of people because they need a lot of sort of temporary work, and just try it. And so I did, and I got hired as a messenger in for the GA in 1988, I would say, September 1988. And I had to go outside of the country to actually get my visa, my student visa, changed to a visa for the UN. It was a specific UN visa that you needed then. And you could only get that outside of the United States. So my boyfriend and I, we said, okay, let's travel. And we were going to go to San Francisco. We wanted to go to California, never been there. So, and then we said, well, we wanted to drive up north. And so I said, let's go to then Canada, and I'll go to Vancouver and go to the United at the embassy there, and I get that changed. And so we kind of arranged a trip. It was a two-week trip, and we flew into San Francisco, drove up to Vancouver, took a week or so, you know, every day, a few miles kind of stuff. And then, but we went to British Columbia. We didn't go to Vancouver. We stayed at Victoria.
Hmm.
Yes, we went to Victoria because we wanted to visit Victoria. And then I said, we'll just take a day trip to Vancouver to do this whole business with the embassy thing. And so we're having a hell of a time. It's wonderful. And we get on the ferry to go to Vancouver. And I get to the embassy. And the embassy, the military guard in front of the embassy is saying, oh, the embassy is closed. We just closed. You just missed it by a minute.
Hmm.
And I freaked out because I needed that visa so I can start to work at the United Nations. I had all that paperwork with me. It was sort of like, to me, like a life or death thing. And I just freaked out in front of him. And he was like, you know, this is this American military dude, kind of, you know, they're all, you know, no emotions, totally strict kind of stuff. And I guess somehow he must have felt something. He said, okay, just let's take a minute, calm down, let me ask. So he went in. And then he came out and he said, okay, you can go in. They're going to allow you to do it. They're making an exception here. So I got in, and they were really nice. They were really nice. And they gave me the visa within, I don't know, 10, 15 minutes. They did it, and I walked out. I was so relieved.
Mm.
It was like one of those moments where I got, oh my God, my life is going to end right here. And then we had a great day in Vancouver. And then I think we stayed in Vancouver for a couple of days. Anyway, so then I started to work at the UN as a messenger. And talk about stereotyping and profiling. So messengers that were of European descent, and let's just say, or had special connections to high UN officials, or were, you know, within the administration, get the job as a messenger on the 38th floor, which the 38th floor is the floor of the Secretary General. So that means you're serving the office of the Secretary General. And then there's, you know, the Secretary building in the UN in New York, you know, it has all these different floors, right? And there's like 6 or 7 floors that have messenger stations, where it's a big room, it's right in the middle by the service elevator. There's an official elevator and there's a service elevator, and that room is usually always by the service elevator. And that's where then 5 or 10 or 6 or 7 so messengers are stationed, hang out until somebody calls from an office and says, I have a letter that needs to go to the floor 2162.
Yeah.
And then you go there, pick up that letter and deliver it to that office that is 2 floors up.
Yeah.
And that's how communication, that was all, you know, pre-email, faxing existed, but they weren't faxing to each other.
Mm-hmm.
You delivered mail to each other. And the secretaries and the assistants couldn't be asked to deliver this stuff, so they had this whole messenger service.
Yeah.
And during the GA, there was a lot of commotion, there was a lot of stuff that was happening, so they needed a lot more during that time. So they hired these people on a temporary basis, so I had a 3-month contract to be messenger. And when you started, you got divided into which station on what floor. And the higher you go, the higher the people that you're serving.
Huh.
And so there was, and the messenger service in general, the administration, without saying something, but there was a lot of people from the Philippines, let's put it. There were certain administrative areas within the United States that were run by one group or another.
In the United Nations.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
United Nations Secretary in the 80s. All I can say, when I was there, this is my personal experience and nothing else. And so I ended up on the 38th floor, and there was a Danish girl, I remember, there was a Canadian, and they were both always sort of the star messengers. She was tall, blonde, beautiful, gorgeous, and he was also very tall, very good looking, spoke English, French, of course, and they always got the great jobs. And so when the GA was actually on, in the GA, the General Assembly itself, that big room that is on the first floor, you know, at the hall, there is an annex to it in that sense, there is an office to it, and so when the Secretary General is there, there's always two messengers that are stationed right there.
Mm.
And they were the ones who always got that job.
Oh.
Because I was there now for 3 years, or I worked there for 3.5 years. Not as a messenger, I got a different job later, but anyway. So it was always sort of this, there's a lot of placing people in certain positions at certain times,
mm-hmm.
and it fits that typical rich country, white person, get the better jobs kind of thing.
Mm.
For sure.
Mm.
So, if you want to call it racism, also I hate to use that word because I think the word racism shouldn't be used today, unless it's historical speaking, so to speak, because it's a human race. We are one race. There are no races. So, it's just sort of more of a profiling that happened.
Mm.
I think more of a colonial, imperial thinking, whatever you want to call it. So that was a lot of fun, actually, being a messenger there on the 38th floor, because you got to deliver mail, and sometimes you could look into those envelopes because they weren't sealed.
Mm.
And so you kind of just got to see what the hell are they, like, you know, sending to each other. Sometimes you send some package of chocolate, or somebody forgot their socks that they left at somebody else's apartment for some reason,
mm.
that you then delivered or something like that. I mean, there was a lot of things going on and happening that weren't above board and were really sort of not cool. But anyway, it was very interesting, very interesting. And I was there doing. There was one. It was the big Congress on Children, I think, and it was for the first time where like the most amount of heads of states came ever together.
Mm.
And being that we were on the 38th floor, we could actually really see what was going on. And so, you know, the security was insane. You saw the sharpshooters on all the buildings on the roof,
mm.
and you watched them all. And it was also, we were there when, and it must have been Gorbachev. Got to be Gorbachev, yes. When Gorbachev came and met with the Secretary General, and I think that was for the first time.
Mm.
And Shevardnadze was at the time.
Mm.
And so that was obviously before the wall came down. And they met on the 30th floor, and I remember that you had the KGB and you had the CIA guys. And because we were in the service elevator, which was sort of off the main corridor, but we weren't allowed to leave the room, but we like snuck around, we like looked around the corner,
mm.
and it was just so interesting to see, and you knew right away who was KGB and who was CIA.
Mm.
I mean, that was so clear, and just watching this, observing this, and how they then met and they shook hands and kind of were able to see that, and just that whole protocol that's around this, and the whole pomp that's around it, and
mm.
the whole sort of official artificial kind of meeting,
mm.
that is so unnatural feeling,
mm.
but at the same time you got all hyped up in it.
Mm.
It was really exciting to watch, and it was really exciting to be part of it, and it was great to even be part of it. It's like we were a little fly on the wall kind of thing, because nobody saw us. You know, we were like the people that were, you know, were not to be seen. We were to service, but not, you know, to deliver, but not to be seen.
Mm-hmm.
We're supposed to. We were the emails of those days.
Yeah.
We were walking emails. And so, you know, and sometimes secretaries kind of were funny and they opened up to you and you were all like proud that they talked to you, and especially the Secretary General was like, oh, and she got to know you, and when she met you in the bathroom, we actually shared bathrooms on the 30th floor, the women, you know, and it doesn't matter what job you had. And so when they got to know your name, you got like all proud that it's like, oh, she knows my name now. Maybe she calls me the next time she needs something, you know,
mm.
she requests me or something like that. So it became this kind of thing that you got all proud when they knew your name.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I was the only German at the time that I remember who was part of that whole messenger group.
Oh.
So and so there, it wasn't a lot of Europeans. It wasn't that many.
Hmm.
And as I said before, but we were looked upon as a little more privileged than others
hmm.
among the messengers. And it's not something that we did, it was something that came from the outside.
Mm-hmm.
That was already it's like this mini, you know, UN is all the countries.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I have to say I love the UN. Even though when I left 3.5 years later, I was extremely disappointed, and I went through this, you know, the total young, idealistic hope UN, we all talk to other, we will be one world, peace forever kind of thing. And then I left and going like, oh my God, this is insane. Because the UN is full of discrimination, prejudice, intolerance from every level, on every level.
Yeah.
And the smallest things.
Mm.
And this rich versus poor, white versus not white.
Mm.
It was so penetrating on every level.
Mm.
On every level. At the same time, I've met a lot of great people. I had a lot of friends from all different countries. There was one who started with me as a messenger who was from India, and we always had lunch together in the cafeteria. It was great. It was like I would have never had an experience like that.
Mm-hmm.
And he told me about his family, and he had a brother who was in the Special Olympics, and his mother was in the committee of the Indian Special Olympics kind of thing. And so there were people from all these different places, and we were all doing well together. We were all, there was no difference.
Mm.
We're just happy, you know, we're doing our jobs. Anyway, UN 3.5 years, it was pretty cool. After about, I think, 6 months or 7 months being a messenger, I all of a sudden got called into an office on the 21st floor, which was the Assistant Secretary General for General Services. He was, I think at the time, Richard Foran, he was Canadian. And he had a director for General Services, his name was Per Sjogren, and Per Sjogren's secretary was looking for an assistant for her and him, so that when she's out, there's somebody else who can do the job as a secretary and assistant, and to help her when she's in, because she has so much work to do. So somehow they pulled my file, she looked at resumes for messengers, and my contract was going to expire anyway, because I think they extended it one more time. 3 months and then 3 months again. So she pulled me in, she kind of interviewed me, and then he checked me out, so to speak, and next thing I knew, the next day I was starting, sitting right behind her in that office.
Mm.
And I wasn't a messenger anymore. Now I was promoted. It was a big deal. Everybody was like, wow, how did you do that? And I said, I didn't do anything. They just pulled me. I don't know. And I later asked her, she said, well, you were studying at Hunter College, because I was still studying at Hunter College, and she said she wanted somebody who was educated. She herself was of Swedish origin too, and German origin. So I also think that there was some profiling going on. Clearly, I think there was definitely. Also, she was really cool. She was a real cool person, and I think I would not want to speak bad about her at all, because she was very helpful and she was always nice. And even my boss Per Sjogren was great. He was a career diplomat, UN, Swedish, started very early on, somehow got involved, spoke fluent Arabic, and was with the UN for 20, 30 years. And he always said, you know, you just stay here long enough, you'll get just as disappointed and as, feel really bad about the UN and think it's all crap, which he did at that point. He was totally... He didn't think the UN had any real function, was doing anything. So his whole optimism that he said he had in the beginning was eradicated.
Mm.
So now he was just doing his job and he was going to wait until he retires, which he didn't have that many years.
Mm.
So, and I said, no, I'm staying optimistic. No, we can change the world. You just have to believe it. You just have to do it. And so I just did secretarial stuff.
Mm.
And at that time, that was between 88 and 91. That's when I worked at the UN. And so in those years, what happened? The wall came down. I remember being in my office, getting a phone call, being told they're chipping away in the Berlin Wall. And I'm going, what? And I remember Dick Foran actually asked, Are you from the East or from the West? And I said, of course I'm from the West. If I was from the East, I wouldn't be sitting here. I was like, oh, what ignorant Canadian. But it was the UN, so of course there's also East Germans, but never mind that. Anyway, so the wall came down, and the first Iraq war happened. And I remember also sitting in the office, listening to the Security Council discussion about making the decision to go to war, to invade, because Hussein invaded Kuwait, and the whole discussion about should the UN get involved. The UN got involved, as we know. So I was all part of it. And at the same time, and those days too, what happened was Namibia became independent. And it was actually a moment where I could have had a chance to go to Namibia and be part of that peacekeeping force, or that civilian administration force that built up Namibia, which I didn't. And I could shoot myself in the foot and I didn't, but anyway. So they were really exciting years being there. And being that the office was responsible for all the buildings of the United Nations, wherever it was, Addis Ababa, Ethiopia, was a lot of stuff always happening, Vienna, and then of course UN New York. And so my boss was responsible for everything and anything that had to do with these buildings that they run, that they get administered, that they are maintained, everything that dealt with that. And at the time, Kofi Annan was Assistant Secretary General for Human Resources. And he was a good friend of my boss, for sure. So he came often, we saw each other, we kind of sort of, I can say I knew Kofi Annan when he was just a... he was always, Kofi Annan had a very good reputation always among staff. Most people kind of, when they're, because UN has also this dual system, which is almost like a little like the university, where university has staff and faculty. And, you know, there's different benefits, and, you know, there's a different, let's just say, importance being put on these two groups from the university level, and UN to general services and professional services. Professional services, you had to have at least an MA to be a professional services. You got more money, you had actually a professional job. And general services was anybody who was support, from the plumber to the messenger to the secretary, all that, you know, we were the support staff. We were supposed to, you know, be the service people for the professionals. And so, anyway, he was always, so among the general staff, he was Kofi Annan was very respected and appreciated because he was just as nice to the general staff as he was to the professionals. And so he was known for that reputation. Like he's a nice guy and he doesn't care who you are and what you look like. While most other people at the UN had definitely their attitudes towards who they spoke with, when they spoke to you, and why. So that was kind of interesting. And so then I remember things like when Iraq, I think when Hussein, when the war was over, there were negotiations in Dick Ferrand's office about the gold that Hussein was supposed to have taken from the Kuwaitis, and where's the gold? And you got to return the gold. And I remember a couple of the head of the Department of Secretary came a couple of times, and at the time it was kind of see his face, and I can't come up with his name now, walking into Ferrand's office, and it was just all this like, it was this big deal, and we were all like, ooh, ooh, but we were just like listen in, and we couldn't, and then Hussein's foreign minister, Tariq Aziz, came a couple of times for meetings. So it was all fascinating. It was really interesting just to watch this from sort of the sidelines. And then one thing more, and then I'm going to stop about the UN. But one day, so the things that happened at the UN and why it was also fun is that one day I come in, I had brought in my passport because I needed some stamp or something, or I needed to make a copy of it. And my boss calls me in the office halfway into the day and says, listen, can you go to France tonight? And I go, sure. Do you have your passport? I said, you know, it happens to be that I had brought my passport in. He said, yeah, I need you to go to France right now, and I need you to deliver a fax machine. It's a coded fax machine that needs to get delivered to Paris because there's negotiations going on between the French and the Cambodians. And that was 91, 1990. That's when the negotiations happened about Cambodia.
Hmm.
And the UN was administering it. It was in Paris and offices there. And they had sent an encoding fax machine there, but it ended up somewhere in Africa.
Hmm.
It got lost in Africa. So, and the people in Paris said, we need that fax machine. We need to communicate, and it has to be in code because they didn't want everybody else to be able to read it, right?
Mm-hmm.
So they had these special fax machines. And so my boss was responsible for that. So he said, you know, I'm gonna have a person travel with it. This way we can do it quicker. Because
yeah.
if I go the official channel and we send it again, who knows if it gets lost again? It goes to customs, it's all official, any paperwork, you're never gonna get it the next day.
Mm.
So I said, okay, I go. I just the way I was dressed. I just had a jacket on. I still had my bagel with cream cheese, which my sister ate next day when I met with her because then I went to see my family. So I flew to Paris that night with that fax machine. At that time, Pan Am still existed. And my boss was friends with the head of the Pan Am office at JFK. So I got into like the business class and then flew business class or first class or whatever it was. It was like nobody else on the plane really. Was empty.
Yeah.
I was treated like it was this like, you know, attitude of like I'm a secretary. It's like, oh, this can't be for me. This is like too much. This feels so weird. And I at the same time enjoyed it. So I end up in Paris, and the way they were doing it, they were basically saying I'm traveling like a private person with this package, and so they were hoping that because I'm this innocent person, spoke hardly any French, that I could finagle myself through the customs, which I didn't know anything about.
Uh-huh.
I had no clue. I just know I had these papers, and this is what you do. And I said, okay, I'll just do that, right? And so I